Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2017. Lecture 1, delivered on January 23, 2017. The title of this lecture is Introduction to Finance.
Today, special topics. The first thing I'm going to do is go back through some of the material from the first time we were together as a happy family last week. Those of you who didn't run out of the room screaming and change your major to fine arts, you now have to face the prospect of having me ask you some questions about what I taught you in the last class. Madam, what's your major? Okay, we're going to change that, right, to something specific, because every employer is going to say, what's your skill set? So you're going to change it to finance, okay? Not accounting, finance, okay? What is a cost in finance that is completely ignored in accounting? Can you tell me one? Or a cost in accounting that doesn't mean anything to us really in finance? Okay, exactly. Very good. You can have a cookie. You should really say, we are not interested in historical cost. Yeah, that makes you sound really formal, fancy. Historical costs, that's what accounting has to be about. But in finance, we cannot care about history. What we care about is what is going to happen next. The last thing that happened, maybe. The next thing that might happen. Because we can't live in business in the past. We just can't. We do not survive in the past. The past is a frozen thing. And there are many corporations that I can cite to you right now that have lived off their past glory, and as they wallowed in their once greatness, they have so ignored the future that they have died. Can you think of a retailer that was an 800-pound gorilla, possibly the origins of the retailer in the United States that is gone, is dead, or is struggling, is on its last legs now, twitching along? Kmart's one, definitely. It's almost dead. There's one that's much larger. What? Bingo, Sears. Sears, the greatest catalog company on earth. The company that probably should have led the internet revolution. It was the first company to do catalog, remote sales. And there they did. They dropped the ball. They screwed the pooch. They drank the acid. They didn't make it to the future. And there they were, living off their past. We were once a great company. Your grandma, your great-grandma, your great-great-great-great-great-grandma shopped at our company. That doesn't matter to this time now. Kmart is another one. A great company for lower-income people. Losers like me shop at Kmart. Because I didn't want to shop at Walmart. But the problem is that Walmart just ran them into the ground, just ground them down and destroyed them. Because Kmart still wanted to live off the blue light special sign. And that is a death knell for a company. Now, another company in the same regard probably has somewhat better prospects. And I'm going to show you how to read stock screens next week so you can see that what investors are thinking about different companies. One company, another big box retailer, a competitor with Sears, that is actually in a little better position, but they too ignored the future. Can anyone think of another biggie? Macy's. Yeah, I hate that. Macy's is the only place I can find shirts that fit. But I was thinking of JCPenney. JCPenney. You go in there and you can still smell your grandma. No, seriously. I mean, I smelled my grandma and she was from Kentucky. Bad smell. Okay? That's the problem. But JCPenney is promising reform. The problem is that investors are beginning to suspect that all they're swearing to God that they've gotten the message probably isn't enough. Now, you take other companies. For example, there's one that was your target. They aimed at you, and you aimed at them. And they understood that in order to survive, they would have to spend an awful lot of money. Boatloads of money, truckloads, shiploads of money to stay on track with the future. They both wanted to keep going and follow their original demographic as it became young professionals while still maintaining their position to appeal to you as their next wave of the old demographic. Now they've been criticized. Oh, you spent so much money and now you don't have any profit. And I just play fiddles for those investors. This company knows what it's doing, although it did stumble with putting those grocery stores in its stores maybe a little bit. I'm not sure about, well, we'll see. Time will tell, but it's still a strong company. Can you think of who I'm talking about? Go on. Where do you go to shop when you want to feel a little upscale? Target? Yeah. No, not Target. Target, for heaven's sakes. Yeah. I mean... Yeah, they dig themselves on their financial statements, but there's accounting. Oh, God, look at those financials. They spent a lot of money. Well, no, let's talk about the future. What is this going to buy them? Okay? So you understand that historical cost and history itself really don't tell us a lot, unless we're looking for something about what trends, and you're going to see me taking apart financial statements back and forth, looking for the trends. Is there something whispering in here about what the future is going to hold for this company? And so we will look at financial statements. Don't get me wrong about that, but we have to appreciate that history doesn't matter. Now, another cost, a cost that is not considered by accounting, that is hugely important to us in finance. It's the cost of the best foregone alternative. Madam, what is that cost? Oh, I love it when you talk like that. Yes, work it, girl. Yes, opportunity cost. What we don't get for the decision we made. We got a new project. You already work for the company. I'm going to put you on that new project. Well, it doesn't cost anything. You are a cost of that project because I've given you up on what you were already doing. Companies vastly underestimate the costs of their projects sheerly because, well, we own it, we don't have to worry about that cost. Yeah, you do. Years ago, I was when I was teaching at a private school here in this area, a very upscale, preppy university. I won't mention its name. We had at the time a mayor of Bloomington who saw her vision of a sports arena. And she was going to, that was going to be her legacy, having this sports arena become a reality. So she wanted to promote it everywhere in the community. So she wanted to speak to all of my business students, all of them. There was a large contingent of business students. And so they all came in, all preppy and all that, the way they are. They dress and look really preppy until they get back to their dorms where they do blow and do all kinds of other things. But there you go, college and all that. So she came in that night, and she brought her finance manager for the city of Bloomington with her. He was on a dog collar. Come, boy, come, sit. And she told all this wonderful stuff. And then because she knew that I wanted these students of mine to see the numbers, she had him speak. And so she gave him a little dog biscuit, and he began to talk. And he showed all these impressive numbers. This was back when Excel wasn't as common as it is now. And the first thing was he was talking about revenue. He talked about revenue. He said, we are going to, at this convention, at this concert arena thing, going to have a 60-mile radius around Bloomington. Who am I kidding? Around Bloomington. 60 miles, they're going to be selling tickets around Bloomington. Now, why is that in and of itself absolutely ridiculous? Talk to me. What's within that 60 miles? Yeah, Peoria, the convention center. Also, if you're not in Peoria, you're out in the middle of nowhere with Ma and Pa Kettle. They're not going to buy tickets to see some heavy metal venue. Oh, yeah, Ma, let's go see some grindcore tonight. I'm feeling frisky. Okay. Dead on the revenue end. And then it gets to the numbers on the cost side. And I was waiting for my students to say something, but they were too afraid to ask a question. I said, where is the cost of the land for this? Oh, we own that land. And I said, you own that land. And I gave him a look. He knew exactly what was going to happen there. Yeah, he was just going to find out that he was on the basement level of a multi-level outhouse. And I had just taken a dump from the top. And he heard it coming down. You own the land? Yep. You know very well that land is still a cost of this project. Why? Because you could sell that land. You could lease that land for another project. What is the cost of the next best alternative? That's the cost of that land. In the middle of downtown Bloomington, are you nuts? Ignoring a cost that large? I mean, there were all kinds of other flaws. And as you see, what has happened? What is the financial situation with that thing? Does anyone know? It's lost money. It bleeds. It bleeds like a stuck pig every year. It bleeds so much that the American Red Cross really doesn't need to be in business anymore. That thing is bleeding red ink every year because they refuse to look at the realistic picture of their revenues, and they refuse to look at the realistic picture of their costs, including the opportunity costs. Now, there was another cost that I brought up in the first lecture. It was the one with the gas station. Do you remember what that one was? What cost? What was the name of that cost? Madam, I'm guessing you're about 20. Somewhere in there, 21, 30. Easy, easy. Whoa. Look, the point I'm trying to make is, what did it cost? Maybe about 15 grand for you to be born? Okay. We're going to insure you for 15 grand if you die. We'll pay off 15 grand. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. Because it's going to cost a lot more than that to replace you now with who you are and the skill sets you've developed. Replacement cost is what matters in finance. Your accounting statements are going to show you the cost of the original thing. But to replace that, I double guarantee you, is going to be more and probably a lot more for a number of reasons. Inflation is only one of those reasons. You build a factory, it becomes a living organism that begins to settle into the structure of the company's mentality, its ways of doing business, its ways of production. So if that factory burns to the ground and you have to start from scratch, you are going to have a lot of cost of just learning how to live in a new factory. Replacement cost matters, not that cost of the original. Replacement cost. Another cost that's absolutely important for us in finance. Madam, do you consider me a nice person or a gruff, aggressive, abrasive, annoying jerk of a person? A or B? Yes, probably B. Good. I want to make sure you understand that before we go to what's going to happen next. Okay. You come to me and you bought $100 worth of stock. Okay? And the stock has fallen down till now your portfolio is worth $10. You say to me, well, I'm thinking that I better hold on to this until I recover my investment, until I get back to $100, until I make it back there. And I'm going to say to you, do you know where that $100 is? You're going to say, it's in that stock. I'm going to say, no, that stock is not there. What am I going to say next? That $100 is with Jesus. It's in heaven. It got wings. It's gone forever. You will never see that money again. That $100 is gone forever. One of the hardest things that we have happen in our lives is when we lose money and we are not going to get it back. I had a friend of mine. He was so stupid. He was walking around in Milan and he sat down at a nice Italian cafe doing selfies of his stupid ass. And that's when the gypsy just came and walked and took away about $5,000 worth of camera equipment. Oh, I'll find him. I'll find him. No, you're not. Yes, I will. No, you're not. Walk away from it. It's gone. Forever. It was my pictures of a lifetime. Well, they're gone. You see, this is the thing that we have a hard time with. But in finance, we have to accept it. You wouldn't be surprised. You would be surprised at the number of clients. One of them was just a classic example. $16 million, they'd already dropped into a project. They were trying to decide whether they were going to put the last $6 million, it was something like $6 million into it. Well, we got to keep going. We've already put $60 million in. No, you haven't. That $60 million is gone. It's over. Stop thinking about that money. It is not there anymore. The only thing that matters to the future is whether or not this last tranche of money, that $6 million, is going to have a good return on investment. You were already stupid. Stupid dies very quickly, fortunately, in the world of finance. It's gone. And so now it's time to move on. The $6 million, is it going to make you a good return on the investment commensurate with the risk? No, the $16 million is there too. Where? Well, it's in the ground. Oh, that's dirt. That's dirt and concrete. Yeah, that's where the homeless people go at night to pee. No, seriously, I was talking like this, and they didn't like, actually the president hated me. But he also understood that I was the voice that told them the reality of what was going on. And in finance, we can't say, well, the rules say that we can put this here. We can't say, oh, I'm a creative person. I have this wonderful idea for a project. We can't do that. We have to be the scientists. We have to be the ones who say, this is what's going to happen. I guarantee you that if you don't do it right, and that's another thing too. We're all about looking at the future, forecasting, the expected future cash flows, all of that kind of stuff. And you know what? When we do that, when we look to the future, we're probably going to be wrong. Now, there are some now, and I'll tell you about that, who are creating, they're actually jumping into the future to create it in finance. It's like science fiction, and I'll tell you about that. Few lectures from now, but for us, when we make a projection, we're probably going to be off. We might be off by a lot. That's why I teach you guys best practices, the scientific discipline, the hard-nosed cutting approach where we don't have a lot of sentiment. You see, because when we are wrong, I promise you that someone who wants our job, who wants to hurt our reputation, is going to point out that we were wrong. And that's when we have to turn around and go back to those people. When they say, oh, see, you were wrong about this projection, we say, look, bitch. Oh, well, you don't say it like that. We say, look. Best practices, what we learned in college, what we learned from the best professors we had, what we learned from the textbooks, what we learned from the industry's best journals. This is what we used. You got a better idea? Well, you show it to me. But until you do, My work was as good as it comes. Even if it was wrong, it followed the standards. And that's what you stand behind. Cover your ass with the standards. That's why I'm hard-nosed. And I do caution you sometimes. It sounds like I'm being unmerciful. Well, you know, if I were unmerciful, I'd be unhappy when my cats eat my food while I'm waiting for it to cool. But this is how we have to be in this business. It's tough. Now, I'm going to bring up, I need to bring up a few terms to you before I go on. This is, especially here in this course and a couple of your other courses, is the shock front where we are peeling you away from the common people. You might like to think, well, I'm still one of them. I'm a homeboy and all that. No, you're not. You are becoming educated, and you're going to start seeing words and terms in ways that common people don't use them. You're going to begin to see the world modeled in a way that is more sophisticated, more detailed, and less mystical in a way. And in some ways, a lot more mystical, considering what we're getting into these days. But so when I'm introducing you to ways, words that you already know, but you don't know them the way I'm going to teach them to you, the way you have to think about them in business. Now, understand, I'm taking you into finance to a certain extent, but I'm also teaching you more a larger way of business, the business, an educated person's business perspective. Okay. Madam, I'm a banker. You want to borrow money for a home. You want to borrow $80,000. Okay, well, you see, the first thing I need you to know is that, yes, you're the borrower, I'm the lender. But in technical financial terms, you are the seller of a security, and I am the buyer of that security. You are the writer, and I am the investor. You're saying, well, I didn't write this loan agreement. No, you didn't. I wrote it technically, but that's only because I wanted to make sure it met my specifications for buying it. In other words, I customized the instrument so that I will buy it from you. So when that loan, at the closing, I as a banker will have all these papers and I'll give them to you. You will sign them first and then you'll bring them back across the table for me to sign. That means you are the issuer, and I am the acceptor, okay? When you borrow, you sell. The price that we negotiate is what I'm going to lend you. That's the price. You're selling me a note, you're selling me a security, and I am paying you for it, and the price I'm paying is the amount that I'm lending you. It's not loaning, it's lending, okay? So let's start this way with this term. Less than 1 year is what we call a bill. Well, they gave me a bill. No, actually, you were the issuer of the bill. All you got in the mail was a memorandum reminding you of the bill you issued. You borrowed money for your electricity from the electric company. And now they are giving you a memorandum. You issued a bill so that you could have electricity. And now they are reminding you of that bill you issued by giving you a memorandum of it. You issued the bill. When you use something that you didn't pay for right away, you issued the bill. Between 1 year and, you know, it's funny because I used to say 10 years, and then I saw these textbooks 7 years, and now I'm seeing textbooks saying 10 years again. Doesn't really matter. Anything that is between 1 year and 10 years is what we call a note. So in other words, a car loan would be a note. Do you understand that? Because it's usually somewhere between 3 and 7 years. A car loan would be a classic example of a note. Actually, most of your student loans, if I'm not mistaken, they're due. You have to pay them off within 10 years, is it? So those would actually technically be notes. Okay, now, something that is more than 10 years. Does anyone know what an instrument that's more than 10 years is called? It's called a bond. So, now, the borrower. The borrower is the issuer. We could also say the seller, or sometimes we would even call the borrower the writer of the security. The lender is the purchaser. The buyer or sometimes we'll just call him the investor. I mean, people use these terms all the time, but now you're seeing them used in very special ways, and you're beginning to understand, this is the start of understanding borrowing and lending from a very different perspective, from the perspective of a financial transaction. When Facebook sold all that stock, it was the issuer of the stock. The buyers were these very large investment houses who were investing in that stock. So Facebook issued the stock, and its investment banking syndicate were the investors in the security. When Netflix borrowed $1.1 billion in notes, Netflix was the issuer of the notes, and the borrowing syndicate, the lending syndicate in that case, was a fairly broad base. Those were the investors in those notes. So it doesn't really have to be debt instruments. It can be equity instruments. Common stock is equity. But regardless, this is how we call things. I want to bring up something right here that's kind of a little step towards next time's lecture. Sir, can you read me what's at the top of that dollar bill?
Federal Reserve note.
What's that last word?
Note.
Note. What's a note?
1 year and 10 years.
What do you mean, 1 year and 10 years? It's a borrowing. It's a borrowing for 1 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Well, who's borrowing the money? This is a note. It says note. They're not using that term loosely. They're using it extraordinarily technically. But most people don't understand that. They see this as a third of the way to a decent cheeseburger. But it is a note, you see, because the United States government doesn't have enough money to pay its bills these days. Back when you were very young, we had gotten rid of our budget deficits. We had a very stable tax base. We were actually running budget surpluses. We were talking about all kinds of cool things, you know, free college education, going to Mars, putting up space colonies, paying off the national debt, cancer research, as far as I could see. And then after 2001, there was a lie that there was a terrible recession. There wasn't, so they created the longest, deepest tax cuts in history, which destroyed the tax base. Then we went into two theater wars, and we started running massive budget deficits again. So we have to borrow money to pay our bills. How do we borrow the money? Well, the government issues notes, bills, notes, and bonds. Who buys those? The Federal Reserve buys a lot of them. The Chinese buy them. The Canadians buy them. The Europeans buy them. The Japanese buy them. Everyone buys our notes, bills, and bonds. In other words, everyone in the world lends us money. And the Federal Reserve lends us money. The Federal Reserve buys a bunch of those instruments at the auction, treasury auctions. How does the Federal Reserve pay for the ones it buys? It prints these to pay for them. They are notes. And when these notes come due, well, how does the Federal Reserve pay this note off? It's a debt. How does the Federal Reserve pay it off? How? Can you tell me? The Federal Reserve simply prints more of these and then grinds these up in its shredders. It prints a couple more of these to pay off this one, and then it puts the original one in the shredder. And that's how it pays the note here off. This note will go away in about 6 to 10 years, whenever it wears out, and the Federal Reserve will print some more to replace it. That is the greatest deal on earth. Could you imagine borrowing money when it's due, you just print more money to borrow to pay it off? That's how it works. If you don't believe me, that word was note, right? Note. That's a debt. How else is the Federal Reserve paying off this debt? Where would the Federal Reserve get money except that it prints more to pay this note off? That's not a conspiracy theory. That's just the way it is. That's just the reality. Okay, now, the next thing I'm going to ask you, madam, what is interest? Well, why is there such a thing as interest? Go ahead. Ooh, risk is there, but there's something underneath it. Risk is definitely, don't get me wrong, you're going to see me use the word risk premium. That's the big thing in interest rates. The core interest rate is actually a very small animal. It's a very, very small animal. It's sort of like, well, I won't go into it, but it's interest rates are a combination of things. But at the heart of an interest rate is nothing but a pure rental rate for money. The core interest rate underneath all other interest rates is merely a rental rate that clears the supply of money with the demand for money. That's all it is. So if the Fed prints more money, that core would tend to go down. Supply goes up, price goes down. If people suddenly want to hold more cash balances, well, that would be the demand going up. That should cause the price to go up. So the rental rate should go up on money. So at the base of every interest rate, is this thing called case of real. Now, I got to tell you here. You'll see me write an R for an interest rate. Some 10, 15 years ago, it got popular to use a K for interest rates. It seems to be swinging back the other way now. I'm trying to remember if the book uses an R or a K. But a K or an R, that's an interest rate. Real. This is the one, this a very small amount of money at the base of all interest rates. This is the one that the Federal Reserve can manipulate. It can move it up and down to cause short-run effects on the economy. Now, the Federal Reserve has a checkered history. It was supposed to have a mission, as far as conducting monetary policy, of merely controlling very precisely inflation and deflation. Make sure that neither of those ever happens. That was what it was supposed to do. But then it started getting into the business of helping the government pay bills, helping the economy out of recessions, stopping inflations and all this kind of stuff by aggressive means, saving big banks from their own stupidity. So the Fed kind of lost its way. And it really began to lose its way in the 1990s. The economy was doing incredibly well. The best, longest, sustained economic expansion in American history. Not only was the economy growing, we had unemployment rate lower than it had ever been. But the Federal Reserve was very angry about this because it meant that their power over the economy had gone away. In 2001, the new administration claimed that we were in a horrible recession. We weren't. There was no recession. The Fed actually has rewritten a lot of data. I have the original data to try to make it look like there was a recession. But they supported the longest, deepest tax cuts in history. And that, of course, killed off the tax revenue base. And then we began one theater war, Afghanistan. And then we began another theater war in Iraq. And so the economy began to bleed. The government's budget deficit skyrocketed. Now, the Federal Reserve tried to control what was going on by holding back the money supply that was for small businesses and normal people. Eventually, that caused a buckling of the economy in 2008. And so on September 15th of 2008, we came within about 2 hours of an absolute, literal financial apocalypse of the entire world. I'm not overstating that. We were 2 hours away from it. Those injuries, the damage that happened from that, they will never go away. Underneath the economy that you will be going into is a very serious, scarred, remodeled animal. It's going to be fragile forever. It can't fix what happened. What the Fed has done, however, in starting when they quietly backing away and trying to act like they hadn't been the source of this disaster, they dropped the real interest rate. They just started printing money like buckets, like oceans, like universes to try to bring down interest rates. The banks just took the money and invested it in their own projects. They didn't lend it, which was why the Fed did this, was to try to boost the economy back up. The Fed just dropped interest rates, and it's had them down ever since. This real rate has been way down ever since. The problem is that sooner or later, the Fed is going to have to bring interest rates back up. Because if you keep printing too much money, you will create inflation. And that's the only thing that creates inflation. Raising the minimum wage doesn't create inflation. Greedy corporations jacking up their prices doesn't create inflation. The only thing that creates system-wide price level rise is too much money in the economy for the economy's growth rate. So the Fed knows it has to bring the interest rates back up. It has threatened to for the last couple of years, but it also knows what I just told you. The Fed knows that the economy is essentially so fragile that it could very well cause a collapse if they do it. They know that the injury is so permanent that bringing up interest rates again to where they should be, not likely. Now, you see this case of this real interest rate? Well, we can't see it. It's a theoretical. It's like in quantum mechanics, when I was in high-powered math and physics, we talked about something that these forces, these tiny particles that bound the universe, that created the universe, they're called quarks and leptons, and we can't see them. We can see one lepton. We can see a lepton called the electron. Well, we can see a couple of them. We can see the traces of them, the evidence of them, but we can't see the actual animals themselves. And in finance, this is the quark. The case of real, we can't see it. We know it's there. It's just hidden from our eyes. It is always going to be walking with another thing right here. In the real world, the closest we would ever see is this thing called the risk-free rate, which is the real interest rate plus the expected inflation premium. That's a pi with a superscript e. It's just a notation. Notice the word expected. Now, I'm going to go through this. Ma'am, I decided to hire you as my assistant in my art business. Okay? And I'm a generous employer. I'm going to start you out. You have to work long hours, no question about that, 60, 70 hours a week. I'm going to start you out at $100 a week. I know. Call me generous. Okay, I know. Easy does it, girl. Now, we're going to go to the first year. Your annual review has come up. You come into my office. Yeah, you've been a pretty good employee. Yeah, you were working about 80 hours every week. Wish you could work a little more, but yeah, I guess you do have to get a little sleep. Okay, I'll tell you what. Inflation last year was 2%. So I'm going to give you a 2% raise. Now, go back to work. Go. Shoot. I gave her a 2%. Well, next year comes. You're still being an incredible employee. I'm going to give you a raise again. Inflation last year was 4%, so I'm going to give you a 4% raise. There's your damn raise now. Get back to work. Go. And bring me coffee. Easy. Now, next year comes. Inflation is 6%. I'm going to give you a 6% raise. There you go. There's your raise. Now, understand, there are two things wrong with what I'm doing here. Two things. Can you tell me either of those what's wrong here? Go.
The cost of general goods has gone up 6%, so when you factor that in, it's not good.
Well, it's even actually worse than that, because the 6%, the 4%, and the 2% had already happened before I gave her the money. So at the end of the year, I give her 2%. You had already been beaten up by the 2% inflation. By the time I gave you the 4%, you'd already been slapped around by the 4%. You, all year long, you'd been dealing with that. And then I give you the money, the raise, after it has happened. And then the 6% the same way, after it had happened. That's the first thing that was wrong. Now, the other thing that was wrong was I was giving you, and it sounds like it's kind of the same thing, but it's not. I was giving you historical raises based on historical data. Now, you had 2% after 2% had happened, 4% after 4% had happened, 6% after 6% had happened. What would you want me to give you next year? Give me a number. 2, 4, 6. Instead of 6, what should I have given you? 8. 2, 4, 6. Your expectation would have been 8. See, 2, 4, 6, 8. Even people from Decatur can do that one. Easy. I've got to stop using Decatur in my examples. Wow. Okay. Do you understand? You see, the history is what I'm playing her for. I've already jacked my price. I'm not stupid. I'm a businessman. I've already forward-leaned my prices. But I'm back-leaning your remuneration. So you see, when lenders lend money, they're not stupid. They're not going to give you the historical inflation rate. They're going to give you the inflation. They're going to put in their interest rates what they expect the erosion of the money to be down the road, not now. You see, if I'm a banker, I'm not going to look at what inflation was last year. I'm going to look at what it will be over the next 10 years, because that's where your loan will be, not in last year. So what's going to happen is that the expectation is going to drive that. That can be a disaster. You see, many, many years ago, before you were born, in the 60s and 70s, the Federal Reserve had been printing money hand over fist. I mean, just ridiculous. To pay for guns and butter. We had social programs. We had waged two wars, basically. A war on poverty, one of the noblest things we could possibly imagine doing. But we were also waging a war on communist aggression in Southeast Asia. In other words, we were fighting a policing action in Vietnam. The problem was that cost a lot of money, and then we had all these other things that were disasters at the time. And finally, it began to catch up with us in the 70s. Inflation, printing all that money to pay our bills, inflation began to sneak in on us. But something much worse began to sneak in. Expected inflation. Because every time the Fed said, oh, we're going to cut the money supply and get this inflation under control, they didn't. It was like the alcoholic who said, I'm going to give up the bottle today. No, you're not. Well, I'm going to Alcoholics Anonymous. One in 15 people has a successful experience with Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I'm going to quit smoking. No, you're probably going to die from lung cancer, you fool. Well, we're going to stop printing money to pay our bills. Okay, where's your, okay, what programs are you going to cut? Or what taxes are you going to raise? Well, we ain't going to do that. Then you're going to just keep printing money, aren't you? Bunky. It kept going and going. And President Ford, who replaced President Nixon when Nixon resigned, he said, we're going to whip inflation now. We got these buttons. When? Well, no, he didn't. The Fed kept printing money. Jimmy Carter came into office, and at first, Jimmy Carter, literally, he was a Baptist. He saw inflation as a religious war. He said, I see inflation as the moral equivalent of war. Unfortunately, that acronym is MEOW. Well, unfortunately, also, for the American economy, Carter was a nuclear engineer. He knew what to do, and he fell on his sword in 1979. He put a guy in the Fed named Paul Volcker, who actually did clamp down on the money supply, crushed it. Well, of course, interest rates skyrocketed, the cost of money, supply goes down, cost of money goes up, but no one believed him. So the real interest rate skyrocketed because the supply of money was crushed, but no one believed that inflation was going to go down, so the expected inflation premium was still hanging at 16%. Stupidly high real rate, stupidly high expected inflation premium. Well, the economy spiraled into a death dive. In the 1980 election, Carter was kicked out of office. Everyone thought he was a complete idiot. Fortunately, the economy, well, it was one of these things. Volcker was the one doing it, the Fed chairman. And essentially, he just had to keep his throat on the money supply and ask the economy, do you believe me now? No. Do you believe me now? Oh, no. Do you believe me now? Yes. So by about 1982, the expected inflation premium began to ease back. Interest rates overall began to come down. The risk-free rate finally began to ease off. Then a year or so later, Volcker began to let the money supply grow a little better, and we came out of, and we had a decent little growth spurt. But now comes the other part. You see, because even the risk-free rate is technically a theoretical thing. We cannot see it directly because two pieces are both theoretical. But we can proxy it. We see there's one specific debt instrument that is very close to the risk-free rate, and that's the one we use. Now, I'm going to show you a formula later in this course. It's not a complicated formula. It's actually a fairly simple formula that's very important to us in finance. It's called the capital asset pricing model formula. And I mean, that thing, we have the risk-free rate is one of the things in it. And so we need a number. We can't just live with a theoretical case of F. Give us the number. So the number we use that is close to the risk-free rate, we call it a proxy for the risk-free rate, is the rate, the yield on a three-month treasury bill. A three-month treasury bill is basically so safe and so short-term that it's almost like a pure instrument. It's not, and of course, it's never going to default, so it doesn't have any default risk in it. Now, I want you. Sometimes you'll hear, the government's going to default on its debt. No, it's not, for God's sake. The Federal Reserve will not let it, and the Treasury will not. I mean, we have the power of the sovereign. The sovereign will pay off its debts. It's not going to default on its bills. It can raise taxes if it wants, or the Fed can just simply print more money to pay off the bills, which is what happens a lot, or what we've done frequently in history, the United States simply creates a lie and invades a country and takes its stuff. I mean, what better way? I mean, we do that all the time. Iraq wasn't the first time. We've been doing it all through our history. And so if we really, really need money, well, you know, people bitch when we try to raise their taxes, so we just have a war and we take something. So we're not going to default. So the thing that you'll probably see me use, and I'm going to qualify this later in the course, but we often use a three-month treasury bill to proxy the risk-free rate because a treasury bill is super, super safe. As a matter of fact, in banks, treasury bills and money have equivalent risk. That is, none. However, you know as well as I do that there is not something called the interest rate. You see all kinds of interest rates. You see interest rates for mortgages, for cars, for credit cards, for student loans, for payday loans. So there are all kinds of interest rates. So the question is, how do those different interest rates form? Well, that all has to do with what someone brought up earlier, the risk premium. It has three pieces which are different for each kind of security that you would talk about. The first one that is the classic that I've already been hinting at a lot is the default premium, case of D. Now understand, see that case of F? For the last, I don't know, maybe about, probably 7-8 years, case of F has been a very small number. I mean, you know, less than 1%. In fact, I saw a couple of pretty good examples where it was probably negative. That's weird. But anyway, so case of D can be a zero, a treasury bill would have no default premium. But the default premium is an extra little interest rate boost for the possibility that some or all of the money will not be paid. It's a little boost. It can be a big boost with some kinds of securities. It's a small boost with others. So, for example, in a mortgage loan, the default premium, would that be a very big number or a small number with a home loan? It would actually be very small because it's one thing that's going to always make the default premium lower is collateral. That loan is backed by a physical asset. There's another thing going on with home loans that almost no one knows about. Did you know you borrow $100,000? The house falls to $80,000 in value. You still owe $95,000. You go bankrupt. The bank is stuck with $95,000. But the house can be sold for only $80,000. So the bank is out $15,000, right? No. Because every loan has insurance. And you, sucker, paid the insurance premiums. Did you know that? If any home has a loan-to-value ratio of over 80%, then you have to pay mortgage insurance premiums that will cover the bank on the difference between the loan balance and what it can sell the house for. And most people don't realize, in other words, they took your house away, they paid it off, destroyed your family, you, your credit, and everything, and they came out smelling like a rose while they blubbered to the entire planet. Oh God, look at this, what these awful people did to us. And what's even better about it is almost no one knows about these premiums. You don't have to pay that if your loan-to-value ratio is below 80%. Almost no one knows it. They don't even know they are paying that. And they pay that mortgage premium in every monthly payment for the entire life of the loan. And the bank in the mortgage insurance company, mortgage insurance guarantee company is the big one, Magic it's called. Those, they make out like a bandit on these. and they don't lose money on most of the loan defaults. They don't, because there is mortgage insurance that covers them on the delta between what you owed and what they could sell the house at. But you're the one who gets ruined, even though you were the one who insured that bank so that it didn't get hurt. Case of D, for a home loan, it's not big at all because the banks know that they're covered. However, now let's try a car loan. Case of D is, remember, collateralized loans have a lower default premium than uncollateralized. So a car loan should be collateralized, right? But it still has a somewhat higher insurance, higher default premium. You've heard that when you drive a new car off the lot, the price goes down, value drops by about $1,500. Well, that's where it comes in. Because if you default on the car loan, the lending company would probably be stuck for at least the first 24 months of the loan. You're upside down on that loan. I just got a very nice new car. I drove it off the lot. And I knew right away it wasn't as bad as I thought it would be. According to this one site, I lost like an 18 grand car. I lost about $1,200 on it. So actually, I'll be paying payments for like about a year and a half before I'll be right side up. So if I go bankrupt, if I default on the loan, the bank is going to be stuck for some money. That's why the loan interest rate on a car loan will probably be larger, although oftentimes the car companies hide it in the price of the car. They sneak it in that way. Okay, now the next one in this is what is called the maturity premium. Now, this is a double whack on the lender. Let me explain this. Okay. My good student, I am the bank and you are a home buyer, wants a loan. Now, I know as a general rule that you will hold a loan on average for about 7 years before you'll move on. That's kind of the general rule. So I'm going to lend you the money, and I'm going to charge you an interest rate of 7%. I, as the investor, the lender, the buyer of your bond, am going to hope to get 7% interest for at least 7-8 years, maybe longer, I don't know. Okay, now, we're in year 3 of the loan, then year 4, and suddenly interest rates drop on home mortgages to 4%. What are you going to do? You're going to refi so fast. Well, you see what that does to me as a banker? I'm screwed. I was expecting to get 7%, and you go and refinance at 4%. I'm hurt. I'm damaged by what happened. You see that, right? Because I had invested with the expectation, it was all on paper, 7%, and then you go and do that to me. Okay, now let's take it the other way. Suppose you were thinking about, you know, moving out of your house, your family has grown, you've adopted 7 kids, and things are going rather crazy, and suddenly interest rates go up to 20%. You going to sell that house and buy a new one on a loan?
Not
a 20%. That's right. If interest rates go up, you're going to stay in that home. You're going to dig a new basement. You're going to have some of the kids sleep in the garage. And the bad ones can sleep out in the backyard with the raccoons. And you'll build a second outhouse. You know, for the teenagers. You know, they like to primp in the mirror. So, you understand? No matter which way rates go, I, the banker, am hurt. Because I would really love to have you pay off that 7% loan so I could lend the money out at 20%. You're not going to do that. You're going to hold that. So if interest rates go down, you refi, and I'm screwed. If interest rates go up, you're not going to go anywhere, and I'm going to be stuck with 7% when I could be lending it to this guy, this sucker, at 20%. You understand? But I can't because you've got a 7% loan. You ain't going to let go of it. So you see, as the longer the life of a loan, the more likely interest rates are going to move. So if I've lent you money for 5 years, well, maybe interest rates will go somewhere in that. But man, if I've lent you money for 30 years, there's a real good chance that interest rates are going to go down or they're going to go up. Either way, I'm screwed. So the maturity premium is going to be a bigger number the longer the life of the loan, because there's a longer time for interest rates to move adverse to me. There's also another aspect to it too, uncertainty. If we're in a time period when banks and other investors see a lot of cloudiness about what's going to happen to the economy, what's going to happen to interest rates, that is also going to make the maturity premium bigger across the board, across maturity times. And that's what's going on right now, by the way. We're seeing a lot more concern. And I mean, you get these investors, oh, the sky's low, it's a wonderful time. Free markets are going to be everywhere. I just love it. But a lot of the smarter investors, the quiet ones who aren't blustering and taking insane risks because they snort crack, the ones who are more mature, they're saying, we are really worried because we know that the economy has this fragility that goes clear back to 2008. We know that the world has suddenly really turned against us, and they are all these alliances have formed. The SCO is out there. I mean, NATO is not as strong as it was. We are very concerned that we are in a period when we don't know as well now. So in a period like that, with uncertainty, the word uncertainty means in finance risk. And risk means higher interest rates. Risk means higher interest rates. It's just as simple as that. In a low-risk economy, interest rates will be low. But sooner or later, if the economy looks risky, you're going to see interest rates go up. Objectively in finance, when we want to know whether a period of time is a good time or a bad time, we look at interest rates. We look at and interest rates drive investments. Low interest rates drive investments, investment spending up. High interest rates drive investment spending down. We look objectively. I told my students last semester, they were very concerned about the election. I said, don't let your passions get to you. Be objective. And if the objective is in alignment with your worries, great. If it's not in alignment with your worries, that's great too. Don't let your passion drive you. Look at the numbers. Look at the risk levels. Look at your own expectations for the future, and don't let your beliefs be biased one way or the other. Now, I'm going to show you the last one here. And in order to do this, I'm going to have to do something here. Okay. Now, this one was one that hit me when I ran a penny stock house. You know, I learned all this incredible, powerful theory at Ohio State, and I wouldn't have been what I was without knowing all this, having this deep philosophical understanding. But when I got out there in the real world, I began to see how it actually was shaped by the dynamics of what was happening around me. When I started my penny stock house, I saw this last one in play. It has to do with how easy or hard it is to unload an investment you've made. Look, when a bank lends you money on a mortgage, a bank gets rid of that mortgage immediately, within hours, if not minutes. That bank has dumped that mortgage off onto the real investors. They bundle yours up with a bunch of other ones, turn into a big goo, and they sell it off. All you see that bank for is they get a fee for servicing, handling the loan payments and all that. They really aren't a part of it after a few hours. But the bottom line is, though, that they can get rid of that loan. They can sell it and get their money back. They lent you $100,000. Or rather, you lent me $100,000. Well, within a couple of hours, that investor there has paid you your $100,000. So you're out of it. In other words, there's a high liquidity. You can get rid of those high-quality loans. The problem was that, and this has been way overstated, there was a very dense market for many decades for high-quality mortgage loans. In the 1990s and the 2000s, early 2000s, a similar market developed for higher-risk mortgages, okay? And there was a lot of, well, that's what caused all the problems, was those high-risk loans. Well, excuse me for lending money to poor people. We should be lending money only to the rich people up in the burbs of Chicago. Oh, damn those poor people destroying our economy again. Really? It wasn't that. But it did cause problems because people at the lower end are much more elastic, fragile to economic crisis. So when the economy buckled in 2008, well, those people with the high-risk mortgages were the first ones to go. So their market, in the secondary sense, was the first to go tap city. You understand the articulation there? Yeah. But understand that there are very dense markets for a lot of different kinds of loans. Now, interestingly enough, car loans, banks and credit unions usually hold on to those themselves. They don't sell them off. There really isn't a dense market for car loans. So a bank can get rid of them, but would probably pay a price. Now, let me explain what this has to do with what penny stocks. Because I talk about all of these interest rates in terms of lending. But it's also in terms of investing in stocks, too. Here's what would go on. I would run my penny stock house, and I made the market in maybe two dozen very small companies. In other words, people could buy and sell stock in those companies from my stock, my brokerage house. Excuse me. Well, okay, I'd have someone call me up out of nowhere. I just saw that you make the market in this stock I bought 10 years ago. Do you really? I said, well, what's the trading symbol? And they go, oh, yeah, I do. Okay. Well, I see that there's a ticker on it even, 75 cents. Well, I want to sell my 1,000 shares right now. No, I'll buy them at 25 cents. Oh, God, they would just have, you son of a bitch. And they, I mean, I was called even worse than that. I was called things that begin with mother. And I'd say anger. Look, and I try to explain to them, look, I buy that stock from you. When am I going to sell that again? You tell me where I'm going to unload that. There's no liquidity in it. I probably will be holding that until Jesus comes back. And he saves, but he's not going to invest in me. God. Okay, now, I want to bring this down home to you. Madam, you're a very rich woman. Oh, yes, you are. Don't tell me that. I know what, I can see you're just dressing down to be in this classroom so you can report back to your masters in the Illuminati. I know this routine. I've had it happen before. I had to shoot someone outside because I knew damn well he was a Freemason. Now, I'm a Freemason, too, but I know the bad Freemasons, and he needed to die. Okay, it was a double tap because he was a zombie. Okay, now, focus. Try to stay on track, please. Okay. Now, this young woman is from a very good family. She has a great job. She is everything the consummate student, trustworthy. She wants to borrow $1,000 from you. She said, I'll pay 8%. Okay. Well, that's not, she makes up this nice agreement, printed out with gold filigree, wherefores, thou art, and who farted, and all that. Okay, so now, you charge her 8% interest. Then you're walking down a street in Chicago, near Navy Pier, and this is 2030, and this old, decrepit man. You are my student. Finance class, FIL 240. I remember you. Yeah, I know. I was away for a while, but I got out of there. They That straitjacket couldn't hold me, not after I lost all that weight and took those laxatives. So here, pay attention. I need $1,000. I'm going to write you an IOU, $1,000. Now, how much interest do you want me to charge me? You going to charge me 8% like her? No, you're not. You're going to charge me more. Because you see, if you really needed the money back that you lent her, you could sell her note to someone else. But this thing that I wrote on an old card that you don't know where it's been, you're stuck with it. That's called the liquidity premium. And taken together, you put those three for every given investment, they will be in a different combination of sizes. And you put it all together and you get the interest rate on a security. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.